Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been a stellar month for space geeks with news of water on Mars. Briny, intermittent, seasonal, but still the real deal, H2O. Adding to the Mars excitement, a new movie starring the red planet has received rave reviews, drawing even non-astronomy types into the idea of Mars exploration. Meanwhile, much farther out in our solar system, the demoted dwarf planet Pluto got a boost recently with some actual photos giving us our first hard look at its frigid, rocky surface. Today in The Exchange, our sky guys are here to help us sort out all this news in astronomy, and let's hear from you too. Your questions and comments on Mars mania or the peeps at Pluto or other astronomy headlines are welcome. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our sky guys are Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center and coordinator of its NASA Educator Resource Center. Mal Cameron, welcome back. Good to see you.
Hey, great to be here.
Also with us, John Gianforte, astronomy instructor at Granite State College and UNH, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. His website is theskyguy.org. And John, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura. Great to be here.
So we understand you were at the movie this weekend, The Martian, the big opening weekend. As a astronomy guy, a sky guy, what'd you think?
I loved it.
Really? How come?
It was great science, great plot, great interaction. Great cooperation, which is the way space travel should be done. Just all around good. Just a couple of nitpicking little things, but we'll talk about them later, and they're hardly worth mentioning. The movie was great. If you like space, go see it.
And if you don't like space,
go see it.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, really. So what was it? You talked about, you know, great science, great cooperation, because that's the way it has to be done. Give us a little bit more there, John.
The vistas of Mars were very reminiscent of all of the past Mars missions, whether you're looking at the Viking missions from the mid-70s, from the Pathfinder missions from 1997, to the Mars rovers after 2004, and even now, Curiosity rover. That's taking place right now while all this is going on. The photographs of Mars terrain, I thought, was depicted very accurately and made me want to go there and take a hike.
It feels like you're there because they really have such great pictures now from all those rovers.
And I went and saw it in 3D, so that really made it
Look
like you were really there and you were part of the mission, and whatever happened to them happened to you too. And that made it more exciting, I think.
Well, and this has gotten a lot of publicity, but just for those who don't know, so the premise is there's this Mars mission, which NASA's been talking about for at least 20 years, if not longer. So this group goes, and then there's a dust storm, and they think one of their crew members has died, and they take off, they leave the planet, leaving him behind. Again, they think he's dead. And then something else happens. Let's hear a little bit. This is actor Matt Damon.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates and to NASA and to the entire world, but I'm still alive. Surprise. Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me, and I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows.
Okay, and again, that's a clip from the movie The Martian, which opened, and astronomers and NASA and anybody interested in space is very excited about this movie because of the scientific accuracy and the excitement around the idea of exploration to Mars. Today in The Exchange, our Sky Guys are here. We're talking about Mars exploration, and we'll cover some other big astronomy headlines in a moment, including some new looks at the planet Pluto. Excuse me, the former planet Pluto. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Your questions and comments are welcome this hour, 1-800-892-6477. So, as you guys know, luckily this character is a botanist, so he figures out how to make stuff grow on Mars. Could somebody do that for real, Mal Cameron?
Well, they're doing it right now in space.
Out at the International Space Station.
At the International Space Station. The latest thing they've done is they've grown some red lettuce on board, and they found a way to do that. They actually tasted it, and it tasted good. I don't know why they would be nervous about, well, we just grew this in space, and maybe it won't be good for us, but it works. So we've proved that the technology is there. So, sure, you could find a way to do it on Mars. The difficulty with Mars is the soil you're using is pretty much sterile, so you have to get your own way to add nutrients and so on to it. Now, I did not see the movie, but I'm reserving that because I promised my son that we would get together. He lives out in Ithaca, New York, and I said we're going to visit him at the end of the month, and we'll see it together.
Right.
That's our tradition that we do when these movies come out. But I did read the book, and so I know all the stuff that goes on. And all the technology, as you were saying earlier, has been proved by NASA. They have something like with the habitats. They're doing habitat studies these days. And without getting too much detail from the movie to spoil it all, but every technology that you see in there is possible on Mars.
I'd love to get your thoughts, too, John, on that. Again, you said that the movie is very accurate, except for one area that we'll talk about in a minute. But could you do what Matt Damon does in the movie and create a greenhouse and actually grow enough food to survive?
Well, I mean, even missions to Mars have proven that the Martian soil is capable of growing stuff, right? But as Mal said, because Mars has no ozone layer, there's no shield from ultraviolet radiation from the sun and from outer space, from interstellar space. So that has a tendency to break down any organic compounds in the soil. So you do have to add materials, enriching materials, just as you would to a garden in the spring before you plant. So he has an inventive way of doing that in the book and in the movie, which in theory would work. And certainly if you have a pressurized chamber that you can control the temperature and humidity in, as he did, yes, you can grow things in space.
Now, you're further from the sun than we are here on Earth. So is that a problem? Not enough sunlight?
Well, yes. I mean, the length of the Martian day is similar to the one on Earth, right? The length of the day on Earth is 23 hours, 56 minutes. The length of the day on Mars is 24 hours and 37 minutes. In 22 seconds. So it's very similar length of the day.
details.
Well, but you're further.
So you are further, right? So Mars is further from the sun, so you're going to get less energy, solar radiation. But if you have a way of controlling the temperature while still allowing sunlight into your greenhouse, you could certainly grow crops.
Well, again, there is that one big inaccuracy in the movie that they put in for dramatic purpose. And I want to play a little piece of Andy Weir. He's author of the book, The Martian. He's speaking with NPR's Arun Roth on why he decided to keep this one element in, even though he knew it was scientifically inaccurate.
The biggest inaccuracy in the movie is straight from the book. So it's also a big inaccuracy in the book. Is right at the beginning, the sandstorm that strands him there. In reality, Mars's atmosphere is 1/200th the density of Earth's. So while they do get 150-kilometer-an-hour sandstorms, the inertia behind them, because the air is so thin, it would feel like a gentle breeze on Earth. A Martian sandstorm can't do any damage. So I went ahead and made that deliberate concession to reality, figuring, not many people will know it. And then now that the movie's come out, all the experts are saying, hey, everyone should be aware that the sandstorm thing doesn't really work and Mars isn't like that. So I have inadvertently educated the public about the force of Martian sandstorms. And, you know, I feel pretty good about that.
Again, that's Andy Weir, author of the book The Martian, that the movie is based on. And what do you think about that whole idea, Mal? You're a former astronomy and space educator. So that idea of a movie creates a lot of excitement, a lot of interest. There's this one inaccuracy, and everybody says, hey, 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 that's not right. And so he says, yep, and now folks know.
Well, it's okay because you're writing a piece of fiction. So you have to have some way to get him stranded. And so you make up something that's a little inaccurate, but the rest of it comes along just fine. It's interesting about on Mars, there are sandstorms. There have been times where you could see global sandstorms on Mars. But
from the Earth, you could tell they were having a sandstorm.
Yes, because you couldn't see the features on the surface through a telescope. The big thing on Mars is dust devils, like little mini dust tornadoes that go across. And it brought to mind when I heard that clip that years ago there was a problem with the original two rovers that were on Mars, the Spirit and Opportunity. And they sit there and dust comes by and it collects on the solar panels.
Oh, and that hurts their ability to
operate. And that will
operate.
Lower down the efficiency of the solar panels enough so that you can't do as much. But there were also instances where a dust devil would happen to come right across the top of the rover, not do any damage, but just enough to sweep off the solar panels and clean them up again. And suddenly they get more power and say, oh, great, we can do this. So it's not something that's going to blow you away like a tornado or whatever.
Well, that's why the rovers are still at least one of the Mars exploration rovers, Opportunity, is still roving,
right,
even though it had a 90-day guarantee. Right. And it's more than 10 years on Mars because the solar panels are getting cleaned off irregularly, right? Because whenever these dust devils blow nearby and blow the dust off the solar panels,
they keep going.
And
are
that
you sure there's not a Martian who's doing the housekeeping for us there?
Well, we're not absolutely sure because we're not there, right? There could be. He could be out of sight, but I don't know.
Let's talk about that point that you make, John. You know, we're not there. I mean, how much does the rovers and then this movie and then this new development that we're going to talk about in a minute, the actual water on Mars, how much is this feeding into the whole, you know, let's go there mania?
Oh, I think this movie will increase popular interest in traveling to Mars and exploring. I think it does as well as it does showing good science in a Hollywood movie, which is very rare. It also, I think, will inspire younger people to say, wow, that's a neat place to go. And, you know, he keeps talking about in the movie about being the only person on the planet and the vistas. And, I mean, it's kind of a neat historic perspective. I think it's going to do a lot for creating public interest in Mars and in going to Mars.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. At one point he says, I'm the best botanist on this planet. And you think, you're the only botanist on this planet, at least as far as we know. What do you think, John? Excuse me. Yeah, Matt.
Oh, he's John. I'm
Matt.
I was just thinking, we were talking off air earlier about talking about inaccuracies and comparing this movie with the movie Gravity that came out a year or so ago and how many inaccuracies were in there. I mean, there were a lot of liberties taken on that particular movie. Very popular movie, and it was exciting, but a lot of it just never could happen. But here's a movie where just about everything, just get past that first sandstorm and he's stranded. But everything that he does is based upon fact and doability, if you will, on Mars. So it's pretty exciting to see the possibilities of going there. And imagine being there in person and being able to pick things out. That would be the big thing. You may like to know the Planetary Society has come up with a plan to do something similar to that. Their plan is to want to get humans to Mars, but first of all, they just want to orbit Mars. And if they land on anything, it'll be on one of Mars' moons rather than on the surface.
Now, why is that a better idea or a better preliminary idea?
Well,
anyway?
Just because it's a little safer, perhaps. Landing on Mars, you land on one of the satellites, the moon, you're not going to have to worry about a lot of atmosphere to go through and land. You could be a little simpler that way. And you have a way, since you're orbiting Mars, you could be orbiting Mars and doing extra studies really up close in that sense. Then their plan is not to actually land on Mars until late in the 2030s, like 2039 is their aiming, but do the initial idea in 2033 to orbit on one of the moons. And the reason for that is funding, primarily. Part of the deal was that if they could get Congress to just go along with this, this would not cost as the billions and billions that the, say, the Apollo program did when we went to the moon. It wouldn't take that much money as long as Congress would agree to keep NASA funded at the rate of inflation. That's their key. That would be minimal amount, and then NASA could keep up with a program like this. So that's a very conservative approach to getting to Mars. Now, a lot of people are saying, let's go to Mars in the 2020s. You know, let's get there. And this movie could actually come out and say, yo, let's go next week. You know, this is exciting. Realistically, they're putting it off a lot further than what I had heard earlier.
The number again here on The Exchange for you to join us as we sit down with our sky guys, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at some of the space science in the new film about human travel to Mars. And in a moment, we'll talk about the new discovery of water on Mars, liquid water, not frozen, not past evidence, but liquid water right now. The Exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we've been talking a lot about Mars, the movie, and all the science and excitement around that. But there was some real life excitement about Mars just recently. Here's Jim Green, NASA Director of Planetary Science, talking about the discovery of H2O on the red planet.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
So again, that's Jim Green, NASA Director of Planetary Science. And John Gianforte, this was a huge, huge deal.
It was very huge. We've been doing space updates on the Exchange for many years, and we've always talked about Mars. It's been a popular topic. And we've always talked about, is there water on Mars? And let's follow the water, which has been NASA's mantra. And they continue to do that because where we find water on Earth, we find life. And we all know that Mars isn't Earth. But if we find liquid water, we knew that was a big step in hoping to find life of some kind. Well, this was a huge discovery when the Phoenix lander landed in the far north part of Mars back in 2008. We found water ice, pure water ice. Well, now we know that there's, in certain seasonal occurrences, liquid water just beneath the surface, and it's spreading to the top in these rills that you can see.
So there was a lot of sort of dancing around that this isn't a rushing stream, John, though. I mean, when I first heard the news, I thought, ooh, water on Mars, you know.
That's a very good point.
Go ahead.
That's super, because it's misleading to hear flowing water on Mars.
Right.
And that's a big – that's a very important distinction to make. The atmospheric pressure, there's not enough air in Mars's atmosphere to create enough pressure – at sea level, so to speak, at zero elevation, to keep water in the liquid state. It's warm enough in places on Mars for water to be liquid, but there's not enough air pressure. It's 1% as thick as Earth's atmosphere. Mars's atmosphere is 1% as thick as Earth's atmosphere.
Wow, that's not very thick at all.
It's barely there at all. So if you put a cup of water on your front porch, and it was, you know, 65 degrees Fahrenheit, which it can be on Mars during the day, it would simply evaporate and become part of Mars's atmosphere. But what this tells us, these lines and rills on these craters that we now know is the result of perchlorates, a certain kind of salt that's dissolved in the water that lowers the freezing point of water. There's water flowing beneath the surface, and it's kind of being mopped up or absorbed into the layers of soil above the flowing water and being evidence on the surface as these rills or these grooves that
mopped
we see.
Mopped up very quickly, John, because the atmosphere is so thin.
That's
it doesn't
right.
take long for it to dry up. Not
at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, these things are completely absent in the wintertime when it's too cold for this briny water to exist. So it's not running rivers where you could go fish in the rivers. There's just no water, surface water available on Mars at all because the atmosphere won't allow it.
What do you think, Mal? There was this big announcement, big headlines, and then when you read further, there's all these caveats. Well, it's only there sometimes. Well, it's pretty salty. Well, it's not really flowing.
It is seasonal. It's only in the summertime when things are warm, as John was saying. It has to be warm enough to do it, but it just doesn't last that long. And I get a kick out of the wording that they use. They don't come out and say there's these long lines that are wet that come down these slopes in the summertime, and they're long and thin. So we're going to call them recurring slope lineae. That's what they call them.
Yeah,
so it's RSLs. You listen to them talking at a news conference, and that's what they were saying. Well, we discovered these RSLs, these recurring slope lineae. Recurring meaning they come by every summer, and they're going down a slope, and they're long and thin, so they're linear. But as John was saying, the salt in there helps lower the temperature down for freezing, for liquid water, that is. So does show up on a regular basis, and not just in one spot on Mars. It's several spots. One of them is even in the canyon on Mars, the Valles Marineris, as they call it, the Mariner Valley. And so it's found in all these places. But what does raise the excitement is that if we can go there, there's more of a possibility to find sources of liquid water that we could then use chemically for to actually drink it if we need to, but also break it apart chemically into oxygen, hydrogen, make fuel, all kinds of things go up.
Make fuel?
Fuel, right.
As in rocket fuel to get back?
Yes.
Exactly, yes.
Wow.
You do want to come back sometime, probably.
We talked about that in our last show, actually,
right.
A group of people who have signed up to go and maybe
way,
not
right.
come back. You know, but on this idea of finding water, briny and intermittent and unreliable as it may be. I did hear, John, for the first time, I heard one NASA official say, this water could be a resource for future explorers. I was pretty struck by that.
Well, I mean, if these lines or these RSLs, as Mal likes to call them, Mal and NASA.
No, NASA likes them.
if this is evidence of water beneath, well, why don't we drill 3 feet, 1 meter, 2 meters, 6 meters below, and maybe we can get some of this briny water, purify it, and we can drink it. We already know where we can get ice cubes on Mars. The water at the Phoenix landing site and other places on Mars is pure water, not briny. It's water, water you could drink. You can make ice cubes out of it, put it in a drink, and have iced tea. So we know that water is okay. But this is more accessible liquid water just below the surface.
So you'd have to bring your own tea mix, but you'd at least have ice cubes.
That's one less thing you'd have to pack.
There you go. Okay. More with our Sky Guys on the latest astronomical news. We'll follow up a little bit more on this idea of water on Mars and then move on to Pluto. All that's coming up in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our Sky Guys are here, John Gianforte and Mal Cameron, and we're talking about new excitement about Mars, given the discovery of liquid water on Mars, although some caveats there that we're learning about. We're also going to hear in a moment about Pluto and some new up-close photos of the rocky, cold planet. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. So, guys, a couple more questions about this announcement of water on Mars. Salty, briny, but still water. Mal, to you, NASA officials keep saying follow the water because it could lead to signs of life. But then others have said this water is probably too salty. Help us figure that out. Can we really say with certainty too salty?
Well, I'm not a chemist, so I, all I know is that and my question comes, well, our oceans are salty and we have life there. There's fish and so on. But I suppose if you get too much salt, that, you know, there must be a fine area where that's where life would exist. If you go beyond that, it would go. I can understand that. And that's possibly true. I don't know, John, maybe you can continue to add to that?
Yeah, I'd love to ask you too, John, because, you know, it may be, quote unquote, too salty for organisms we know, but maybe there's other organisms that love being in a salty environment.
Right. Well, we have these extremophiles on Earth that can live in extreme conditions. It's a great example. But it's the kind of salt that NASA is talking about in this briny water, as they say, is not sodium chloride, the same kind of salt you put on your French fries. It's perchlorate salts, different kinds of materials that we call salts, but it's not salt that you shake out of your shaker. It's a different kind of salt. It's very, very salty, and it's a result of Mars's planetary chemistry. So, but you're absolutely right, Laura. If life forms ever sprang up on Mars, they're going to have grown up with the chemistry that's available on that planet. And deep within Mars, there is going to be running water like Earth has aquifers. And who knows what level of salinity is going to be present in that water. And if life has been around for a billion or more years on Mars, they're going to say, hey, what are you talking about? This is great.
Yeah, this is fine. Yeah, so, we love this.
So that's a very distinct possibility. We shouldn't put limitations on what life likes or doesn't like, because we have that same level of extremism here on Earth with our extremophiles.
Well, one more question about this. Again, these dark streaks, because this, as you guys said, it's not rushing, flowing water. It's more these dark streaks that seem to get wet during the spring and summer and then disappear as it gets colder. I read, John, that one of the Mars rovers that's still scooting around the surface of the red planet is close by to these dark streaks, but NASA isn't going to send it to figure out what these dark streaks are about. How come?
Well, that's a good point. And I believe it's the Opportunity rover is the closest one, to some of these streaks. And it's all about the level of purification, or when you send a spacecraft to a world you're not sure about in terms of whether it's habitable or life would like it, even kind of life that you don't know much about, you sterilize it. You spend a lot of time, money, and effort to sterilize it so that in 10 years, 100 years, 500 years, you don't discover life on Mars and discover that it was life from Earth that you brought to Mars, and it found a place that it was found cozy and started a family there. So you want to be sure that your spacecraft are sterilized,
so that the data you send back is accurate. This is Martian life if you find it, not Earth life that inadvertently was attached to your craft.
Exactly. And that's really hard to do because life is tenacious. It's not wimpy, right? Earth life can live in little corners of a spacecraft, even in near vacuum conditions, in a spacecraft.
Wow.
So it's difficult to be sure. So what they don't want to do is they don't want to bring a spacecraft that could have any possibility to contaminate a portion of Mars where liquid water might exist, because the liquidness of that water could transport a hitchhiking Earth microbe to points beneath the Martian surface, and then, you know, so they're trying to be very cautious about this.
Yeah. And you don't want to create any contamination, too.
Exactly. And not that you would want to bring any Mars bugs back, but you don't want to bring any Earth bugs there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
There's a great example of that years ago on the Apollo missions. I'm thinking it was Apollo 12. When they landed on the moon, the second landing on the moon, they landed it near a space probe called, I think it was called Pioneer,
Surveyor.
Maybe?
Surveyor 3.
Surveyor 3. Landed right close to this. Surveyor 3 had been sitting on the moon for 2 or 3 years. And, of course, the moon is an environment where there's no air, no atmosphere, and all the radiation from the sun is hitting it on a regular basis. And they were able to walk from their Apollo lander to the Surveyor craft. They scraped off some of the insulation or whatever on the outside of it and took some samples home to test it. After this was sitting on the moon for this long period of time, getting irradiated on a regular basis, they took some of that material, put it in a Petri dish, and it grew.
Wow. Wow.
The tenacity of these of this is really quite interesting. So, yeah, that's a big thing. And even during the news conference for the water on Mars, when they were announcing that, that was one of the questions. If we send things to Mars, is that going to interfere? It says you can never get anything absolutely sterilized. You do the best you can. And the methods, of course, over the years have gotten better and more efficient. But there's always that little chance you have to be aware of.
Wow, that's a really interesting story and makes your word choice of tenacious just perfect, John. I mean, this idea that something could still grow and thrive after it had been on the moon for a couple of years, getting irradiated on a daily basis is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you guys about another big, big, big discovery in astronomy science. I also want to invite our listeners to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Our Sky Guys are here. We're taking your questions and comments about some of the big headlines in astronomy news, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, gentlemen, finally, Pluto, John Gianforte, some hard pictures of a planet that is very, very, very far away. When was this mission to Pluto, New Horizons, when was this launched?
This was launched in 2006. Yeah, January of 2006. And when it left the Earth, it was the fastest spacecraft ever to be launched from Earth, about 40,000 miles per hour, which is really booking. But still, because Pluto is so far, and in fact, when it was launched, Pluto was still a planet.
I was going to ask you that.
Right? That didn't, the motion didn't come until August of that same year, so they didn't fire the rockets and make it come back, which is good.
Good thing New Horizons took off in January. Yeah.
But it took all this time to It really made it out to the outer solar system very fast. But Pluto's really far. So when it did get there on July 14th of this year, it had been traveling all that time from January 2006 to July of 2015, more than 9 years. And even in the weeks before it got there, we were just surprised by the images that it sent back, how interesting, how fresh the planet and its big the dwarf planet and its moon Charon looked. Some of the vistas of Pluto with mountains and even gases in the atmosphere and ice on the surface and places on the surface of Pluto that didn't have many craters, which means the surface is young. Whenever you see a planetary surface that has no craters on it, it doesn't mean that the planet was lucky not getting hit. It means that the surface is there's something going on in the planet to cause the craters to be erased.
Well, that 9-year voyage is just incredible, and a couple billion miles, right, to get out there, John. Let's hear some sound of team members at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Laurel, Maryland. This is the moment when the New Horizons spacecraft phoned home, as people put it, and did let everybody know 9 years in that things were working and it was ready to start taking photos. Let's hear.
We have a healthy spacecraft. We've recorded data of the Pluto system, and we're outbound for Pluto.
Yeah. Okay, so they were pretty excited there, and you can understand why after 9 years. So, Mal, what have we learned in the couple weeks that that this spacecraft has been snapping photos of Pluto?
Well, we got to look at Pluto, this went by pretty fast, but they got lots of pictures and so many that initially they had not the high resolution pictures that we're getting now. And those are going to take probably the better part of a year or more for them all to be dumped down to us. And they keep getting more and more things. One of the more recent things, which I found just yesterday, actually, that came through on my email, was that they found on Pluto's large moon. They have now Pluto's an interesting system because initially back in the late 70s, they discovered this big moon that was orbiting around it. They call it Charon, which is C-H-A-R-O-N. The moon itself is probably at least half, or it was two-thirds the size, I guess, of
half.
Pluto. Half. It's the comparison between it and the dwarf planet, as we call it now, Pluto, is massive. So much so that the center of gravity, the gravitational point at which they orbit, it technically does not orbit around Pluto itself.
Like our moon
does. You can kind of think of Pluto as normally a planet would be standing still and the moon going around it, and it may affect it. It may wobble slightly. That's it. But the center of the point that they orbit, they both orbit a point out in space. So they're actually both kind of going around each other. It's so big. And that is greater than the relationship between Earth and our moon. Our moon's about a quarter the size of Earth. So they discovered yesterday on that moon, Charon, that it has a bulge on the lower, the southern hemisphere, very much like Mars has, that they say created the big canyon on Mars. There's also a canyon on Charon.
Oh, so some similarities there.
And there's some, they think that because of the frozen water, when water freezes, it expands, and that may have something to do with it. But also there's something they call cryovolcanism going on.
That sounds
which
like something from water, Star Trek. Water, yeah.
Water-based volcanoes that are shooting up through there to help some of this happen. This is a new discovery as of yesterday that revealed it.
Wow. Say that again?
Cryovolcanism.
So it means like
so
a
So it's not lava, but it's like liquid-based lava.
What I'm amazed by that. I'm also amazed by the fact that they could know that stuff from billions of miles away.
Well, they have good pictures. And they know the sensors of seeing what they're looking at as well.
On the volcanoes on Charon, not on Pluto, right?
Right.
On Charon.
There's probably the same thing going on Pluto as well, because when the spacecraft got close, and they're very close, I mean, the spacecraft flew within 7,750 miles of Charon. So that was really close. And because it was so close, it took these fantastic pictures, and it could see this bulge that Mal was talking about. That looks like it's caused by some kind of, I won't say tectonic in the same way that Earth has tectonic plates, but stuff happening from within the planet, water freezing, making a bulge, a slight bulge in the moon that is manifesting itself with mountain ranges and other cracks that you wouldn't expect in a world that far from the sun. But as Mal said, if the video that you can see of Charon orbiting Pluto clearly shows that the center of gravity between these two planets is not at the center of Pluto. It's somewhere between the two. And you can see them moving around this unseen center of gravity because Charon is so massive and big compared to Pluto.
Yeah, which is also why they sometimes refer to it as a double planet.
Yes.
Because they sort of move in tandem with each other?
Yes, and because they're both orbiting the same central point out in space rather than one orbiting the other technically.
Wow.
They're both orbiting around this point. In fact, that came up in consideration in 2006 when they demoted Pluto. They were thinking that maybe Charon should be a dwarf planet as well.
But they finally
said, okay, we'll fudge this a little bit. And we'll still call it a moon of Pluto. But now there's, five moons?
They didn't want to upset people too much by demoting or upgrading one and demoting another. You know,
exactly.
You guys may be answering this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The National Academy of Sciences has ranked the exploration of the Kuiper Belt, including Pluto, so this is all these objects that are way, way, way out there, of the highest priority for solar system exploration. How come, John? I mean, it's pretty far out and it's very frozen. So why is this the highest priority for solar system exploration, at least as far as the National Academy of Sciences is concerned?
Well, it's not going to affect the stock market, that's for sure. However, when you look at places in the solar system that are, let's call them pristine, in that they're so far away and so cold, and where it's cold, chemical reactions and processes take place very, very slowly. So that's the proximity. That's where we are at Pluto and in the Kuiper Belt out beyond Pluto. So things don't change much out there. So the interest in this part of the solar system is this represents the raw material and the state of things when the solar system formed 4.65 billion years ago. So if you want to see what things were like at the beginning, go to a place in the solar system where they haven't changed much. And they haven't changed much because there's not the energy there to cause the change.
Wow, so it's like a time capsule, really.
Exactly. That's why comets, which are some of them have their origins in the Kuiper Belt, are of such interest when they pass through the inner solar system, because that stuff comes to us then, right? So, okay, so it's not pristine once it makes it to the inner solar system, but as it comes closer, we're sampling material that was left over from the formation of the solar system, and it's coming our way in the form of comets. Now, Pluto and Charon aren't coming our way. The other Kuiper Belt objects that have helped Pluto lose its planetary status, they're staying out there, but it doesn't mean that they're not interesting and could shed light on the formation of our solar system and other solar systems, of which we know there are many.
That's the extrasolar planet count that we're going to get to in a few minutes. So travelers from the past, I'm kind of fascinated by the way that John describes it, Mal. It's like a time capsule coming our way.
Absolutely, it is. And it's interesting that there was a statistic that I thought would be of value here, too, is that the United States, actually, is the one country in the world that has now visited all of the planets of the solar system and had probes to them and are now getting into the Kuiper Belt. The one thing that had always been planned is that after we do the Pluto flybys, to go to some other object in the Kuiper Belt and see what the differences may be, if any.
We will talk about that and a lot more in a moment. More space news with our Sky Guys coming up. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're checking in with our Sky Guys about the latest news about water on Mars, extrasolar planets, spacecrafts exploring the far, far, far reaches of our solar system, including some amazing photos of Pluto. And we've talked about the new Martian movie and how that's ginning up excitement for a human exploration to Mars. We'd love to hear from you on these topics and more. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And John Gene 40, Mal Cameron, here's an email that came in from Ben in Hudson, who says, did Earth ever look like Mars during its development? Good question, Ben. Mal, what do you think?
Mars and Earth went through a similar type thing. It's Mars has degraded since then, and that's one thing we're trying to find out. We are certain that it had a larger atmosphere on it. We don't know what happened to it. It probably had water on the surface. There definitely was water on the surface because we find elements and minerals and so on that could only have been formed in the presence of water. Especially with the Spirit and Opportunity, they found these little rocks they call blueberries, nicknamed because they look kind of bluish. But it was, I forgot the...
Hematite?
Hematite. And so they realized that on Earth, hematite most of the time, at least forms in the presence of water. So when the water disappears, it leaves this hematite behind. And they found a lot of that on some of the plains on Mars. So we know water was on Mars at one point in oceans. We're pretty certain we know how the Earth formed. I doubt that we had we don't have the same problems. We've stayed more stable over the years than Mars has, obviously. And that a lot of that could be due with size. We're twice the size of Mars.
A lot of it's due to atmosphere.
And atmosphere.
Right? Yeah. Right. And every time we talk about Mars and Earth, and I love that Ben is asking about this comparison, right. I always feel thankful, Mal, for our atmosphere.
Absolutely.
We should wake up every day thanking the atmosphere.
And we have to take care of that atmosphere, too. That's why all the concerns about pollution and so on are very, very important to address.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben, for the email. John?
If we could turn the question back on Ben and say, Ben, it's more like Mars used to be more like Earth than Earth being ever like Mars. Because once you lose your water or most of your water and most of your atmosphere, it's kind of difficult to get it back again. And as Mal said, small objects, planetary objects, lose their heat more quickly than large objects do. So the theory is that when they formed, Mars and Earth were very much more alike. But because Mars is much less massive, a little bit about approximately half the size of the Earth, it cooled quickly, lost its molten core. That means it lost its magnetosphere. It lost its magnetic field, which protects a planet from charged particles. And it's the charged particles emanated mainly by the sun and the solar wind that can strip a planet's atmosphere away from it. Once you lose your atmosphere, then you don't have a shield, an ozone layer, or a shield from gamma rays or X-rays like the Earth has. So the evolution of the planets departed, of Mars and Earth, departed about 2+ billion years ago when the inside of Mars cooled. It lost its magnetic field. It lost its shield against charged particles. And then it just went downhill from there if you're a life form.
Well, it's a great question, Ben. Thank you so much. Yeah, go ahead, Mal.
Yeah, this actually relates to our job of living here on Earth. The more we study the other planets around us, it gives us clues as to what happened to those planets that could possibly happen on Earth if we're not careful. And, for example, Mars, we know, has been losing its atmosphere. There's a lot of radiation now. It's very dangerous to go. On the other hand, if you go in the other direction toward the sun, you're going to run into Venus.
Which has much atmosphere.
Which is the same size, roughly, as the Earth. And it has so much atmosphere that it's extremely hot. It's a runaway greenhouse, as they say about that. That's got a surface temperature globally on Venus that's like 900-plus degrees Fahrenheit. That's hot enough to melt lead.
Yeah, nobody's talking about
putting human boots. And we don't want to go to Venus. No, we're not going to. We don't want to walk around on Venus. So it would be impossible to do that. Mars is a place, though, that one of the big pie-in-the-sky ideas of Mars is we can go and terraform it.
We can return its atmosphere earlier.
Right? This comes up a lot. Or what is it, Total Recall, I think, where they land on Mars and they're going to have this wonderful thing where I think Arnold Schwarzenegger's eyes bugging out or something about that. But everybody toys with that idea because One thing about Mars is that technically you could move everybody from Earth onto Mars because the total landmass of Mars is the same area pretty much as what's on the Earth, except the Earth is bigger and we have oceans in between. And there are no oceans.
And food to eat and water to drink.
Yes, and we have food we can eat.
And great restaurants.
So if we go back to the movie, The Martian, I guess, make sure if you go to any planet, bring a botanist with you.
Because as we talked earlier, he's a botanist, so he can figure it out, which is darn lucky.
Absolutely. It's fortuitous that would happen.
Yeah. If he were a radio host, he wouldn't. Wouldn't fare as well.
Maybe if you were a radio host, you would have called Earth sooner.
Well,
yes.
True.
Okay, that's one complaint I had about the movies. Now, since you brought it up, Mal, okay, he should have phoned home earlier.
Again, the phone number for you to join us from wherever you may be, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us as we sit down with our sky guys. We're learning so much about Mars and some of the other planets in our solar system. And let's go to John in Hampstead, guys. And John, welcome. You're on the exchange.
Thank you, Laura and Sky Guys. Great. I just tuned in and started listening, and I've been paying attention to Mars for a while, as many people have, and I've studied biology and physical sciences and things like that, and it's always occurred to me that the forms of life that humans are likely to encounter on Mars are probably going to be pathogenic, given their ability to survive in that environment. And I'd like to hear your comments on that and take them offline.
Okay, John, thank you very much. Go ahead, Mal.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. We don't know. It's an unknown thing. It doesn't mean right now, I think if they found life on Mars, life, quote unquote, would probably be something in the form of bacteria and who knows what else. And it would be probably what we would or what John said earlier about extremophiles that we have here on Earth. I'll bet it would seem to be that because it's a pretty bad environment up there, and they have to be a pretty hardy bunch of something in order to survive, especially all these years.
Well, thank you again for the question, John. And John Gene Forty, I did want to ask you a completely different topic, but related. You keep track of what's called the exosolar planet count. And you always do this when you come on the air. It's great. Just remind us what that is, an exosolar planet.
An extrasolar planet is simply a planet that orbits a star other than the sun. And it's a relatively new branch of astronomy. It started in the late 1980s when the first planet orbiting something other than the sun was detected. And in 1995, the first planet orbiting a sun-like star was detected. And since then, we've detected and confirmed 1,968 planets that orbit stars other than the sun. And we found those 1,968 planets in 1,248 planetary systems. In short,
which is amazing.
It is truly amazing. It's not science fiction anymore. Now we know there are other solar systems for sure. And we know that 490 of those other solar systems are multiple planet systems, which means there's more than one planet in the system. So it's not a planet here, a planet there. We're finding that most stars in the galaxy have planets.
The idea that there are a lot of stars, most of them have planets. Maybe they have, you know, 8 like we do. Maybe they have 20. Maybe they have 5. But in short, there's a lot of planets out there. And I can see where you're going with this, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you make conservative calculations on the back of a napkin in a restaurant, there are probably more than 50 billion planets in the Milky Way galaxy orbiting stars. And we've only sampled a little piece of the galaxy that it is immediately within a few hundred light years, maybe 1,000 light years of the sun, which is, you know, 1%. Of the volume of the Milky Way galaxy. There's 200 to 300 billion individual stars in the galaxy. And if half of those stars had planets, do the arithmetic. There's lots of planets out there.
So there's other probably intelligent life out there.
Well, that's the big question
that people have asked.
That's a big jump, right? Where there are planets doesn't mean that there is intelligent life. And where there are planets, it doesn't mean that there is microbial life either. However, the more planets you have, the more likely it is for a place where for the chemistry to have evolved and taken place for life to arise. So that's the thinking.
Mal, I wanted to ask you about the birthday of someone who would be very excited to hear what John
Absolutely.
Is talking about. You're observing the 133rd birthday of Robert Goddard. Now, who was Robert Goddard?
Robert Goddard is what we call the father of modern rocketry. Rockets have been around for centuries because of fireworks and so on invented by the Chinese, I guess. And so those were like solid fuel powder stuff that was going. But Robert Goddard had the first successful flights that I know of liquid-fueled rockets. And he was born on this date, October 5th in 1882, so today's his birthday. I understand we have a big cake out here that we're going to have afterwards. Is that right? But we have to call the fire department.
Yeah,
without.
Right.
But anyway, his first successful rocket flight was right outside of Worcester, Massachusetts. So he's a New England guy. He actually had a schooling in Clark University down there. But the story goes that when he was 17 years old, I mean, we've heard the story. This reminded me of George Washington and the cherry tree, or I think of Isaac Newton sitting under an apple tree and getting inspired. He climbed a tree and got inspired looking at the sky, thinking, I got to find a way to get up there. And in 1926, he did. He was able to fire this rocket. He had rockets that went as high as over 1.5 miles high, and they were traveling over 500 miles an hour. So from there,
not bad.
We come to where we are now. Back here in the 21st century, look what we can do.
Okay. All the way out to Pluto and beyond.
Exactly.
Thank you, Robert Goddard, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Guys, thank you so much. So fun to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Great.
Our pleasure.
Those are our Sky Guys. Again, John Gianforte, astronomy instructor at Granite State College in UNH, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. His website is theskyguy.org. Also, Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.